Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And, Jim, we start with the good. And for those who are regular readers of the Morning Jolt, you'll know exactly where we're headed today. Today is release day for Heavy Lifting, the new book from Jim Garrity and his good friend Cam Edwards, who you probably know from NRA News. It is a funny book, of course. If Jim's involved, there's going to be a lot of humor in it, and Cam is very funny as well. But, Jim, there's a serious message here, as you've explained, as the release date for the book has neared. We've got a problem with quite a few young men in America. They don't show a lot of interest in growing up, and you explain why taking on different responsibilities is a great thing.
This is my attempt to tackle what strikes me as a pretty significant lurking social problem. In some ways, this is one of the most socially conservative things I've ever written, and yet it's not really about what we traditionally think of with those issues of abortion or gay marriage. We maybe touch on it a little bit. Basically, that it's becoming harder for young people, particularly young men, to kind of begin these rites of passages that are always kind of traditionally how you became an adult, right? You went out into the working world, you got a job, ideally you had a career path, meet a nice girl, get married, start a family, and boom, you were suddenly becoming what your parents were. And you know, society and American life could go on. And unfortunately, people are finding that harder and harder. And some of that, you know, you can put lay at the feet of the lousy economy. But I think some of it is that all of these things, growing up, getting married, starting a family, have been kind of become portrayed as something that ties you down, something that kind of limits you, something that keeps you from living a happy life. And, you know, speaking from one happily married father to another, Greg, I think you'd agree, it's exactly the opposite. It's what makes life worth living. And so I kind of felt we needed to showcase the upside of all of these things that you're expected to do, not because, you know, some authority figure on high is wagging your finger and saying you have to do this. It's because these are good things to do. These will make you happy. These make you feel fulfilled. They'll give you a good reason to get up out of bed in the morning, much more than, you know, being a slacker, playing video games, and being the 40-year-old guy hitting on 20-year-old women at the bar.
Well, that's certainly true. And I think it's actually a great disservice to young women when you have so many young guys out there who are just, I don't even know if it's necessarily a lack of ambition, but
extended adolescence, shall we say.
Extended adolescence, exactly right. And there's just so much confusion. You know, there's the hanging out part of culture now, and that might even be true of people who are moving forward with some of these responsibilities in life. There's just a lot of confusion out there. They're looking for a nice guy to settle down with, and for all the people who are out there trying to beat the feminist drum, this is an issue that they probably should be beating.
One little good anecdote from the book. Cam and I, you know, talked to millennial women, 20-something women, and inevitably all have the same kind of tale of they get the invite to the after-work happy hour.
Right.
And they can't tell if it's a date or not. It's kind of like a group thing. I mean, is he asking me out? Is he not asking me out? Should I dress up? And everything's in this kind of murky gray area. Most women said they'd find it amazingly refreshing if somebody just said, hey, you know what? I really like you. I'd like to take you out to dinner. I think they'd be blown away by that because apparently that doesn't happen anymore, Greg.
Man, it's so nice to be married and not be in that scene anymore. And
yes!
obviously to have found the right one is a critical aspect of that as well. There's a lot to learn from this book. And I know you and Cam go back a long, long way. So your chemistry in this book is really great as well. So good luck with the book. I think there's a lot that folks can get out of it. And hopefully a lot of people will buy it.
Thank you, Greg.
All right, on to the bad martini now. And this was a story that actually goes back to Friday. The Department of Justice on Friday announcing that, surprise, surprise, there will be no charges against Lois Lerner, the former head of exempt organizations at the IRS, the spearheader of the persecution, you might say, of conservative organizations applying for tax-exempt status following the inauguration of Barack Obama and certainly after the 2010 midterm elections. These are the groups that had to hand over way more sensitive material than the government should ever be asking for. And then they slow played it so these organizations couldn't be up and running at full strength. They were spending all their time trying to comply with ridiculous requests instead of getting actively involved in issues and campaigning to some extent. And Jim, Eric Holder was never serious about investigating this. I don't know if the new attorney general even looked at this. The fact that the Justice Department finally announced that nothing's going to happen here should come as a surprise to no one, but it is very troubling that that's where we are with our government right now.
How do you feel about that investigation into Hillary's server, huh, Greg?
Not happening.
Yeah.
Here's the first thing. This is a version of what is kind of the classic Clinton strategy. I think it was back in 1998 during the Lewinsky scandal that he trademarked it, of just slow walking everything. If you delay everything, people can get used to almost any new set of facts given enough time. Because when this happened, this was a really big deal. This was a shocking, screaming headline news, as it should be. You're not supposed to use the Internal Revenue Service as a partisan political weapon. Obama said, nobody's madder than me about this. And, you know, most of us, you know, nearly choked on whatever we were eating at that moment. I kept waiting for lightning to strike him. But as we learned more and more about the open, obvious partisanship of Lois Lerner, exactly the wrong person to be heading up what is effectively a law enforcement agency. Increasingly, the emails we saw of hers, she was asked to testify on the Hill. And then she did this cute kind of, I'm going to give a statement and then I'm going to plead the fifth. So I get to say my side of the story, but I don't have to answer any questions. She was ultimately found in contempt. There really were no consequences, certainly no consequences serious enough that anybody in the IRS or any future administration would feel deterred from ever trying something like this again. So it's bad that the Obama administration felt comfortable enough to use the IRS as a political weapon. What is even worse is that now the fact that they know there has been no consequence, I think we've seen the end of an era in which the IRS is, you know, it was never liked, but it was never seen as a partisan tool. I mean, I remember talking to conservatives at the peak of this saying that the only way liberals will learn that you're not supposed to use the IRS as a partisan tool is if they're victims of this themselves. And he wanted to see, conservatives wanted to see the IRS unleashed as a weapon against liberal groups. Now, you might have wondered because of IRS employees, and if there's not enough conservatives in their ranks, they might object to that. Not that anybody objected to this. but the entire thing has been a farce from start to end. The entire blaming of low-level employees in Cincinnati, and it ends on an exceptionally sour note, and I don't know about you, Greg. I can't feel like we've turned some corner here, approaching a banana republic in which the tools of government are really designed to keep the ruling power in power.
No, that's exactly right. And it was a political charade from the start. The president was outraged for about 15 minutes when he first made his statement, of course, saying that he learned about it on the news like everybody else. Democrats in Congress were outraged for the first hearing, maybe two, and then they immediately accused the Republicans of playing politics here. So just a very dark chapter in American history. And like you said, without consequences, it's hard to see how anybody's going to learn a lesson from this. And it's just going to encourage more of it. That's the lesson here. All right.
That's a bad, bad martini, Greg.
She lost her job, but she has her full pension. And she was probably fairly close to retirement anyway. So if that's the only consequence, that's not good. All right. On to the crazy martini now. And this has nothing to do with your perception of Jeb Bush as a presidential option when it comes time to vote next year. But Jeb Bush is already in some trouble, and surprisingly, it's pretty public. His fundraising for his campaign, not his super PAC, his super PAC has lots of money, but the campaign was doing so poorly that last week it was basically revealed that they're scaling back staff a lot, other than in the very early states of Iowa, New Hampshire, maybe South Carolina. Salaries are being cut. Expenses are really being trimmed, even in those states to some extent. And then even had a huddling over the weekend with his brother and his father, the two former presidents. Jim, he was going to have trouble anyway. I think there's still definitely Bush fatigue and some establishment fatigue. But he's been completely unable to adapt to the mood of the base. Trying to figure out how to fit into the political climate this year has been a losing errand big time, at least so far, for a guy you'd think would be one of the more experienced candidates in this field.
If he ends up departing the race a lot earlier than everybody expected, there are a lot of different points we could, you know, moments we could point to as being missed opportunities. I think earlier today I was discussing with someone that first debate, or maybe it was the second debate, where you know, he had, you know, said Donald Trump had said nasty things about his wife. And we were waiting for, all right, this is it. Here comes Jeb Bush. You know, guy talks smack about your wife. That's your chance to step up and show your anger, show your passion. And he kind of sort of did it. But by the end of it, he was like high-fiving Donald Trump. And he wants to be liked even by the bully who's beating him. That kind of crystallizes that difference there. The other thing, which I just thought was a very unflattering moment, came this weekend. He's at an event in South Carolina with Tim Scott and Trey Gowdy. And he's talking about things in Washington. He says, if this election is how we're going to fight to get nothing done, then I don't want to have to any part of it. I don't want to be elected president to just sit around and see gridlock become so dominant that people are literally in decline in their lives. All right, fine. That's all fine there. But then he says, that is not my motivation. I got a lot of really cool things I could do other than sit around and be miserable, listening to people demonize me and feeling compelled to demonize me. That is a joke. Elect Trump if you want that. Greg, does that sound like a guy who's got fire in his eyes and he's ready to go and he's going to win this nomination? Or does it sound a little bit of, I'm going to take my bat and my ball and go home because I don't want to play, you know. He's emphasizing he doesn't want to run if the race is going to be in a certain kind of tone. But Governor Bush, sometimes the tone of the race isn't within our control. I wish there was a higher, more policy-oriented, and more serious tone to this debate, but there isn't. Bernie Sanders didn't want to beat Hillary Clinton on the email issue, and he chose not to. And now apparently the word in Des Moines is that the race is over. You don't always get to choose the circumstances of the election that you're running in. You have to adapt to those. And I think you're right, Greg. This kind of encapsulates how he could not adapt to this. Now, you could say, look, he came into this with a lot of challenges. The family name, the position on immigration, the position on Common Core, the sense that he had been antagonistic to the grassroots. But I think what's most disappointing is that this guy, who's allegedly seen as a powerhouse, a guy who had won two elections in Florida, was considered very popular there, really hasn't risen to the challenge and has kind of sputtered. I think probably the other great example is that, you know, his super PAC spent $24 million in a bunch of these early states, Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. And he did not really see much of a bump in the polls from that at all. I mean, no. Maybe a couple of points here and there. And if you're not getting much bang for your buck now, boy, what are the odds you're going to get some in January and February, Greg?
Not very much. Not very much. And you're right. There were certain moments along the way, and we shouldn't bury his candidacy yet, but the one where he said he was not going to essentially cater to conservatives during the nominating process, you lose the primary for the sake of winning the general, that certainly didn't go over very well. And I don't know that this is the way he thinks when he's on stage in the debates or how he actually feels about the process, but he gives off a vibe that he's annoyed that he has to go through this. I don't know if you sense that as well,
yeah,
but that's what I see.
A fair way of describing it. And, you know, my boss, Rich Lowry, described Jeb early on as a pre-Obama conservative. Well, lots happened in the past 7 years. When you feel like you've been out on vacation for what have been some of the biggest and most consequential fights of our lives, fights over Obamacare, fights over immigration, fights over our foreign policy, Benghazi, right? You know, all this stuff that really matters to conservative voters. And you haven't been there for that. You got to show to them that you understand what they care about, what drives them, and what's, you know, what's keeping them up at night. And I haven't gotten that vibe from Jeb at any point in this campaign. And so it feels like we're writing his obituary now. Look, you know, stranger things have happened. You know, Rick Santorum was at 2% this time in the 2012 cycle, but he doesn't sound like a guy who really wants any more of this grief and aggravation to go on.
Jim, good to be back with you again. Good luck with the book, and we'll talk tomorrow.
All right. Thank you, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Go out and buy Heavy Lifting and join us tomorrow for the next 3 Martini Lunch.